Hello and welcome to the Deep Dives podcast here on the No Ceilings NBA podcast feed. I am your host, Nick Agar Johnson, and this is the first time I've been able to say this in literally years. I am here with my new co-host, Paige Otto. Paige, how are you doing this fine evening?
I'm doing great, Nick. Happy to be back. I know it's been a few years or a couple years, but super excited to be back on the grind and do the show with you.
Yeah, so for just a little bit of housekeeping up top, for those of you really, really old heads who remember back when this podcast was on the hashtag Basketball Podcast Network and Tyler Metcalf was my co-host before he abandoned me for the other Tyler, not that I'm still bitter about it. It's been a while, but we're changing up the format a little bit on the Deep Dive show this year. So again, a little bit of housekeeping up top. Paige and I will be going pretty much every week talking about some of our favorite deeper cut prospects in the class. So, you know, we may get to some of the higher up the ranking guys later on in the year. But if you're expecting to hear about Darren Peterson and Cam Boozer every week, unfortunately, this is not the podcast for you until we get to the quick hits section at the end. So there will be some episodes sprinkled in here and there in the traditional deep dives format of interviewing No Ceilings writers about the various pieces they've written. But for the next few weeks, it's going to be Paige here hanging out with me until she can't stand me anymore, talking about a few of our favorite prospects in this upcoming draft class. So today we've got two highlight prospects to comb through before we sort of get to quick hits at the end, talking about the opening night for the NBA, which is happening as we are recording this podcast, which is excellent timing on our part. We really nailed that. But we'll start out today by
didn't do it on purpose or anything.
No, totally not. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely not that Tuesday is the day that we recorded and also happens to be opening night for the NBA. Yeah. Just completely random and terrible planning on our part. Anyway, so today we are going to be doing what is going to be the fresh new format for Deep Dive. So we're going to be diving deep into two prospects who are out of the first round currently on the No Ceilings Collective big board. So again, we may, you know, switch that up later in the year, cover some slightly more heralded players. We may actually end up going back on the word that I said 30 seconds ago and talk about some of the top guys, but we're going to highlight, you know, maybe not the most draft sicko deep cuts of all to start. We're going to be talking through a lot of second round players sort of early on in the run, and we'll see how it evolves from there. So, you know, depending on what people think of the show, depending on how Paige and I feel about things, you know, we'll adjust on the fly, but we've got a pretty set schedule for at least the first few. And today we're going to be talking about two of our favorite second round prospects in this class. And it's really funny to me that these are the two players that we picked because they're almost as opposite as you can get as prospects. We've got a 7 foot skinny big man who was a zero star recruit, and we've got a 6'3 guard from my hometown of New York City who was number 6 in his recruiting class. And yet here we are, both second round prospects on the No Ceilings board for 2026. So we're going to start with the player who I picked for today, who's actually not the New Yorker, but rather Magoon Gwath out of San Diego State. And Gwath has a lot of the traits that I tend to fall too much for in big man prospects of, oh, wow, he defends, he's mobile, and he can shoot. And, you know, there are a lot of sort of question marks around the rest of his profile. But ultimately, there is always going to be room in the NBA for 7-footers who can shoot, especially if they can defend. And, you know, there have been the sort of classic everybody put on 15 pounds of muscle rumor mongering going on in the preseason. But definitely, Gwath seems a little more filled out than he did last year, which is not the highest bar to clear. But, you know, he's still someone who you're not exactly going to want to throw against Zach Edey and Joel Embiid on a nightly basis. But he's got a lot going for him on the defensive end, you know, in terms of mobility, in terms of being able to protect the paint while also, you know, you don't want him on the world's quickest point guards. But, you know, he's not someone who you worry about fumbling with foot speed and guarding the quicker, sort of more water bug point guard types. So, Paige, before we sort of dive deep in some of the numbers here, I'm curious, what are your thoughts on Magoon Gwath's freshman year and what he might be able to do this year for San Diego State?
Yeah, I think just looking at Gwath at a whole prospect, I'm with you. I kind of fall for, you know, the mobile, lengthy, big four man. You know, there's some questions about his game, right? You know, he needs to add strength, size. I think his second year with San Diego State, he can certainly do that. Injuries have kind of held him back, and there's a lot of question marks there, you know, with his ankle, his knee in the off season. But I think if he continues to improve in that regard, he definitely has that lottery potential of all the tools that NBA, you know, front offices kind of like foam at the mouth at, right? You know, you mentioned, you know, he has an enticing handle. He's not afraid to put the ball on the deck. I think he has that motor that I think even as a freshman, and if you're looking at, you know, the fourth and fives, that is kind of hard to tell right off the bat. Just off the top of my head, I kind of remember when they played Oregon, he was, you know, he's kind of a floater, right? He kind of roams on the perimeter, kind of sometimes in those delayed types of actions that fits his personnel really well. So on this play, he was just roaming on the three-point line, kind of did a little hezzy, right, to trick the defender and kind of drove down the lane really hard. But he drove right into three defenders, right, and got the ball swiped. So he just has to have a better handle. But with that, you know, he got that turnover, but he sprinted back all the way on defense and ended up getting a block at the rim. I forget what Oregon player it was, but that just kind of, you know, gives him that attribute of, you know, what he is when it comes to like his motor and what type of prospect he is, rather than just looking at, you know, his physical tools. His attributes there is like, is he, you know, does he have that mindset as a defender comes into play too?
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought up the mindset, because that's a huge part of this. I mean, you know, you can pick out prospects going back through the years, but two of the examples that always leap to the front of my mind in this regard are Chet Holmgren and very early career Jared Allen. Of you just don't have the physical strength to stand up to these guys, but so much of defense is just effort. And it's like, you know, even if these guys were absolutely massively outmatched size-wise, like I remember one play from Jared Allen's rookie year where he just got absolutely shoved under the basket by Joel Embiid. It was just like he moved like a good 5 feet backwards when Joel pounded and dribbled it. And he's like, okay, but you know, he was there, right? Like there are a lot of young big men who fit this sort of profile of, you know, like last year, Mukun Gwath was listed at 7'190".
Yeah.
Like I, you know, have spent many years harping on the physical development that, you know, that Kings fans saw from De'Aaron Fox over his early NBA career, and very similar thing with Tyrese Haliburton of, you know, just the most obvious baseline simplistic characterization of, oh, he actually, like, you can see more than bone on his ankle, right? It's like, De'Aaron Fox's first year in the NBA was 6'3", 165 pounds, right? So just, and he was so skinny, right? And, you know, again, Chet was about the same, you know, about 7 foot, about, but everywhere, you know, Chet was listed pretty much, you know, between 195 and 210, right? And I think he was probably, especially, you know, once he got to the NBA, he was much closer to 210 than 195. So, you know, it's one thing to say, oh, you know, this guy needs to add weight, but, you know, will it be good weight, right? It's like pretty much every weight that Mukun Gwath adds would be good weight. And it's like, it's one of those things where it's been particularly fascinating to sort of follow the discussion around Victor Wembanyama, you know, what he said himself, what his trainers have said about, we don't want to put on too much weight too quickly, because part of the reason he's so incredibly dominant is that he's not just as big as he is, but he's also as mobile as he is, right? And so, you know, if Gwath were more of a post-up big, maybe it would be more of a concern for him to put on weight. If he was someone who shied away from contact on either end of the floor, you know, maybe it would be more of a concern that he is as skinny as he is. But the competitiveness, I think, is a huge factor in, you know, not just defense generally, but also in projecting someone like Gwath of, okay, you know, he's a teenager, right? Like he's going to put on weight no matter, like pretty much no matter what, like even if he's not trying to, right. But you know, that's the kind of situation where I think that he has a lot of room to go before adding weight will impact his mobility. So the fact that he's as competitive as he is already when he's giving up like easily 20, 30 pounds every night is, I think, a really good sign for his future development, especially again, given that he, you know, will make most of his bones in the NBA level on the defensive end of the floor.
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, strength and weight, you know, is a concern, right? But it's not everything, because it's just, you know, basic, you know, you're going to go play college ball, you know, you're going to get your shot in the NBA, you know, if you're, you know, that type of prospect that, you know, is lucky or, you know, has that type of you know, build an archetype that NBA teams look for, it's not never going to happen, right? You have, you know, at whatever school you're at, you're going to have incredible strength and conditioning staff that's going to give you a plan, you know, nutritional plan, which is, I think, the most important of like what you eat. And, you know, with these big guys too, it's so important. I'm glad you mentioned it. Like, it's important to build weight slowly, but also, you know, maintaining that flexibility, mobility that, you know, we see all these injuries the big man have, especially with their feet, right? So that's going to be super important for Magoon this upcoming season. And I think he's going to get some reps at the center position too, just because, you know, Coleman Jones graduated, right? So that's going to be a kind of a huge test for him. And he's already gained, you know, about 20 pounds, right? And even in his freshman year, he was Mountain West Freshman of the Year, Defensive Player of the Year, posted 8.5 points per game, you know, rebounds kind of on the low side for his size, and his skill set, just about at that 5 rebounds per game range. And he also had, 2.6 blocks per game, which was, you know, first in the NCAA across 26 games started. So I think to say, you know, the main concern with, you know, Magoon and not like putting him in that lottery conversation is his size is kind of, you know, not everything, right? So I think we kind of have to look at the bigger picture with him.
It's fascinating in numerous regards, because as we are recording this, the opening night game between the Oklahoma City Thunder and Houston Rockets has just wrapped up. And Houston's starting lineup was 6'7" Amen Thompson, and then essentially 4 7 footers. And so that's where a lot of the fascination with me comes in with Gwath. Like, even 5 years ago, it's like, oh, he's 7 feet tall. So like, he's A, gotta be skilled, and B, has to play center. Right. And now it's like, you know, and this is a thought that I've had in, you know, particularly bright focus because, you know, I'm living in Sacramento, California, following the Sacramento Kings. It's like, man, it would be fantastic if the Kings could get someone who's a 4 offensively and a 5 defensively, who like can space the floor, who can take guys off the dribble if they need to, but for the most part is not going to get into Domantas Sabonis's way. And on the other end, you know, they're not going to be the guy guarding the, you know, big block guy like Joel Embiid, because, you know, that's about the only player that Sabonis is, you know, decent at guarding. Is just he's huge and strong and hard to move. And so you throw those guys on Sabonis and you let Gwath roam defensively, right? It's like, there are so few players in the league who sort of fit that archetype. And it's why I believed in Isaiah Mobley as much as I did. And early returns on that are not fantastic, although he did get a cup of coffee, which, to be fair, is more than most 45th picks ever get. But, you know, the concept was so easy to me to figure of what NBA team couldn't use someone who can play 10 to 15 minutes a game, be a competent rim protector, and shoot 37% on the other end. Now, I have for years and years and years railed against small sample size in college 3-point shooting numbers, and have, you know, often to my own detriment, been called a free throw shooting truther because, you know, hey, the number that actually translates most directly to NBA 3-point percentage is free throw shooting, because of what I have called the Derek Williams principle of sometimes, you know, you get lucky and you shoot like 40 for 70 from 3 1 year, and people are like, oh, this guy's an elite shooter. It's like, he shot sub 30%, I think, every single season of his NBA career. But man, he had, you know, when the lights were on in college, he hit every shot that he took. So like, you know, 45 3-point attempts is a really, really small sample size to be able to say that someone is a fantastic shooter. His 63% mark from the line is not on that many more attempts, but is also it's a concerning number, certainly, when you're talking about someone who a huge part of the, you know, sort of viewed offensive upside is the shooting. The flip side of that is I was surprised when I dug into the numbers how much better he was at the rim than I thought he was. He shot 67% around the basket last year. Yeah. Like, that's per synergy, that's 84th percentile, which, you know, granted, a big man should be much higher up that list than a guard, but even still, it's like, even with all of the strength related concerns, he's surprisingly fluid in terms of, you know, contorting his body around the rim. Like, he actually did almost better on layups than dunks. Certainly percentile wise, he was 80th percentile layup guy and then missed six dunks. So, you know, graded out as poor on dunk efficiency, but like even still, it's like, okay, yeah. he missed six dunks, whatever. But like for me, a lot of that, I mean, first of all, it was surprising to see that number, but second of all, and more to the point, it's like that shows the kind of skill and, you know, body control of like, okay, if he's doing this when he's at a strength mismatch, basically every time he goes down low, and also he has that aggressiveness that you mentioned of like, I'm willing to drive into three guys and see if I can, you know, get the ball to go in over them. You know, it's funny that I, you know, came into the evaluation with my memory of last year being like, okay, real shooting potential, real defensive potential, needs to put on weight. And, you know, just purely looking at the numbers is like, you know, okay, he shot 51% from the floor, right? But it's like, the reason he shot 51% from the floor is that he barely shot at all. And, you know, when he got around the basket, he was really good. When he took those three pointers, he was quite solid. And he doesn't, it's not like with a point guard prospect where it's like, if you don't have something that you can do between 15 and 20 feet, people can just take the ball out of your hands, right? It's like, you don't want Magoon Gwoth taking fadeaway mid-range jumpers, at least not at this point in his development. So ultimately, the fact that he did much better on the interior than I remember him having done is a really encouraging sign on my end. And then, I don't know. I mean, I really do buy into the shooting. I think his form is solid. I think that, you know, he has the confidence to take them, which is a huge part of it. I would hope and expect that he takes a lot more shots in general, but three-pointers in particular this year. Again, that the sample size is concerning, but, you know, it's a flip side of a conversation that I had with myself about Alex Condon a number of times last year, who I still ended up having a first round grade on. But it's like, if you're shooting a low volume of attempts, better to shoot 38% than 34%, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I totally agree. And with, like, I think you kind of brought up his, shooting form, right? You know, he has such a high release with his size that, you know, that's not a concern to me, you know, if he's going to be able to, you know, put the ball in the basket. He just needs to get that, you know, attempts up, right? I think you mentioned, you know, he had 45 three-point attempts, so like 1.7 per game, close to 38% on the season. And I think with, you know, his second year, you know, you mentioned he's still so young. Like, he already made such an impact his freshman year. With dealing with injuries, I think his second season, we're going to kind of see like a breakout more than we ever probably thought in him, in a sense. And if you look, you know, from last year, you know, Malawach, why am I like blanking? But Malawach, Derek Queen, you know, CMB, you know, they were taken in the lottery, right? So why isn't he in that lottery conversation to start the season? I think on my big board, I had him at 26. I'm not sure if you had him in that range or close
I believe I had him 28 off the top of my head. Okay. Like, I'm pretty confident I had him late first round as well.
Cool. Awesome. So. Yeah. And I think, like you mentioned, you know, we're not really looking at him to be like a mid-range shooter, right? We don't really want him to take those attempts unless he, you know, gets the three-point attempts up and is more, you know, accurate at the rim, even though he's shown flashes at that. But just, you know, from inside, you know, 17 feet, he only shot 30%. And he's had, you know, a few nice turnaround jumpers, but like, if that's not going to be part of his game, and like, nor do you want him to really, like, you know, settle for that, right? So I think this year is going to be super telling, you know, how he can balance, you know, sometimes being thrown in the five spot. How is he going to deal with, you know, being like the guy at San Diego State as well? Will be super interesting.
So we've talked a lot about his offense, and I think that's because there are a lot more questions about his offense. So before we move on to prospect number two, let's quickly talk about his defense. And there's a whole lot of positive to say, which is, again, why I think the offensive discussion is more interesting, just because there are, you know, more potential areas for pushback. Defensively, it's not just that he had 2.5 blocks per game. For him to be the size he is, as aggressive as he is, 2.5 blocks a game, under 2 fouls a game, that's insanely impressive for any big man, but particularly a big man with his profile as, you know, a sophomore in college who's under 200 pounds as a 7-footer. You know, his ability to contest shots, to put fear into the heart of opposing offenses while also not making any mistakes, I mean, that is exceptionally, exceptionally rare for, you know, it's not just, okay, you know, there are a lot of big men who, you know, they're not mistake prone guys, but usually that means they don't have a ton of block shots, right? And there are you know, big men who are on the skinnier side who get a ton of block shots, but, you know, also get called for blocks on like every other play because, you know, they try and take the charge and they get thrown like 15 feet back. And it's like, well, your feet actually weren't set and there's nothing else you can do. So I guess that's just a foul, right? His combination of shot blocking and, you know, just good verticality, just keeping his arms up, not swiping down, all of the above. It's, again, I mean, I'm struggling for synonyms for impressive here, right? It's just, you don't see people very often who have under 2 fouls a game and 2.5 blocks, but particularly in, you know, literally their first season of college basketball, because he redshirted his freshman year, right? It's remarkable. And again, it's the kind of thing where you brought up the rebounding. That's certainly worth bringing up. I think it's very notable that his offensive rebounding rate is much better than his defensive rebounding rate. Yeah. It's something that, and again, I don't think this is the case with Gwath, but I think it is worth bringing up. Back when I was covering the Nets, it was fascinating to me to listen to how people talked about Brook Lopez and his rebounding numbers. It's like, he averaged 6 boards a game. He averaged 7 boards a game. It's like, every single year, the Nets rebounded significantly better with Brook Lopez on the floor than off the floor, because he's one of the biggest human beings I've ever seen, and he would just box people out. It's like, I don't care if my name shows up next to the rebound in the stat sheet, but we are controlling the glass. And, you know, Steven Adams did the same thing where, like, you know, all those years he averaged more offensive rebounds than defensive rebounds. It's like, it's not because he can't grab the ball on the defensive end. It's because he's not trying to. It's because his entire goal is, okay, box out the other guy. The team gets the rebound. We have a possession that we wouldn't have had otherwise. And, oh, well, it only says 7 next to my name in the box scores when it comes to rebounding. So that's always something that stands out to me when I look at guys who are much better offensive rebounders than defensive rebounds, is how much of that is just scheme of, like, his role is. And again, I don't think that's as much the case with Gwath than with Brook Lopez or Steven Adams, but it is something that I always think of. You know, a lot of offensive rebounding is just pure effort. And a lot of times defensive rebounding can be altered due to scheme. And that's something that I wonder if it might be playing a role here, even if he's not the archetype of just, you know, ridiculously large human beings that can't be moved. I do always think about that in the back of my mind anytime I see someone who's like significantly better on the offensive glass than the defensive glass.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned, you know, his offensive rebounding numbers are obviously way better. You know, he was ninth overall in the Mountain West in offensive boards. His season high of 13 rebounds was at Nevada. He had at least 4 games with multiple defensive rebounds. But, you know, it's super inconsistent when you're looking at, you know, those double digit rebounding numbers, right, with Gwath, with, you know, he's more than capable of having, you know, 10 plus games even with, you know, controlling glass. But if you're looking for, you know, a big, like you mentioned, you know, Brook Lopez, Steven Adams, like, that's not Gwath, right? You're not going to look at him to, like, control the glass. That's not his player archetype. But he can certainly, you know, get better at, you know, boxing out, you know, watching the ball more, you know, making sure he's in a great position to, you know, go up and get those boards. And also, you know, hitting the hit-ahead man, you know, when he's out there at the glass like he does on the offensive side of the ball. So I'm looking forward for him to, you know, have more flashes of that this year, which I certainly think he can. And that just goes back to the strength thing. Of, you know, maybe he's not going to get pushed around as much this year with, you know, gaining some weight in the off season, but I'm definitely excited for that part of his game to develop.
All right. Are we ready to move on to prospect number 2?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Cool. Quick break and we'll be back with Ian Jackson right after this. All right. So as I sort of teased up top, to the almost diametric opposite end of the prospect spectrum, Ian Jackson, native of my hometown, New York, New York. And, you know, he plays a lot like a New York guard, gets out in transition a ton, really great around the basket. He's a much better shooter than your sort of quote unquote stereotypical New York guard. You know, a lot of the archetype, which I'm quite familiar with, is, you know, they can score every which way around the basket. But, you know, once you're trying to shoot for more than 10 feet and out, you gotta trust the city rims and the, you know, it's anyway. So, you know, that's what people say about New York guards. A lot of it's for good reason. But, you know, besides the point with Jackson, he came in as a highly touted prospect, you know, again, 6th in his recruiting class. Last year was a disaster for University of North Carolina, pretty much across the board. So, you know, it's hard to put too much blame on any one person for that. But, you know, obviously going from, you know, championship contending one seed the year before to 11 seed and immediately out of tournament is not what people were either expecting for or hoping for from Ian Jackson's first college season. But I mean, he was sixth in his class for a reason, and there's still a lot to like. And I'm far from out on Ian Jackson. I phrase that in a way that makes me seem more negative on him than I am. I guess I think that there's a whole lot of reason why last year was disappointing that wasn't on him. And I think that a lot of what was on him is a little bit more easily correctable than people might think. But this is going to be a huge prove it year for him. You know, this is the kind of situation where sometimes guys come back after a up and down, not particularly impressive freshman year and they become Jaden Ivey. And, you know, sometimes they do that and they become Alex Poitras, right? It's like, it's a real struggle of, okay, how much of this was a concerning development for the player and how much of this was a situation that was just never going to work out. And I'm much more optimistic about Ian Jackson than I am about some of the other players who had very similar seasons who we actually just did our, time is weird, but I believe it was yesterday put out our, this is where the editor in chief thing comes through. And I've read all of these things like seven times and I can't remember what day they actually went out, but
yeah, Big East yesterday.
Yes. That's yes.
I got
okay.
You.
Good. Good. I got that right. But you know, when I was thinking about the, when I was thinking about the St. John's roster, it was like, oh, like Ian Jackson and Justin Sandin had very similar seasons. And I am still very much wait and see with Ian Jackson. And I'm much more out on Sandin. And their seasons weren't all that different. But I just think that the North Carolina situation was weirder than it's getting credit for in a way that's making it easier for me to dismiss some of those concerns. I don't know. I can't tell if I'm being crazy on that or not. So I'm just going to throw to you before I get even more off the rails. What made you pick Ian Jackson for our first version of the Deep Dive podcast here?
Yeah, I think first off, like there's something about, you know, a hometown kid coming back home to kind of like redeem himself after an up and down season. You know, he had an up and down season, flashes, you know, he went on that hot streak that kind of got people, you know, amped up about, you know, his draft stock. And then that kind of diminished, right? And that kind of, say with UNC's season, you know, they were in the first four, got out really quickly in the first round to Ole Miss. But with Ian Jackson, you know, when you think of, you know, the pros, you know, he's such a great driver, right? That's his bread and butter. You know, he's a great slasher. He's a, you know, last year he was listed at 6'4", I believe 190. This year he's at 6'5", 195 pounds. He was second in scoring. But also he was very, you know, kind of hidden in the weeds, you know, from the likes of RJ Davis, Elliot Cadeau. You know, he's your typical off ball player that, you know, thrives in isolation where he can manipulate defenders, but he can also, you know, move off ball extremely well with his athleticism. And he's kind of, you know, a demon in transition in the open court. He's so fast. But he also has, you know, the inconsistencies of, you know, his playmaking is certainly not there. His defense, you know, he makes really, you know, questionable decisions, which kind of led to his downfall, you know, of his, you know, people thought he could be in the first round, but then he ended up going back to St. John's, right? Just because of those inconsistencies. And, you know, last year he was on the ACC all freshman team. You know, I'm not saying, you know, he didn't have really good dispersing qualities. It just the inconsistencies, you know, overlapped of what he was really good at. And if you're not, you know, really good at a lot of things, you're just good at one thing, it's kind of easy to, you know, put him in kind of a box and see if he's going to have that breakout year with St. John's. And just to dive into the numbers a little bit, he averaged 12 points per game, which I mentioned earlier. He was second on the team, 45% from the field, just a little bit under 40% from 3-point range. He hit double figures 19 times, made a three in 30 out of 36 games. I found a really interesting stat. He was the first to score 20 or more points in four more games, just behind Tyler Hansbrough, which is UNC legend, which was kind of interesting. But that kind of just, you know, proves to the point of, you know, he is kind of in that range of like a microwave scorer that he's going to give you a bucket. And that kind of just leads me like, you want him to be Captain Jack again. You know, he calls himself Captain Jack. It's kind of like, where's that dog mentality going to come into play again? And I certainly think, you know, St. John's with Rick Pitino is going to get that done. But if you look, you know, kind of into the numbers even more, you know, on catch and shoots, just a little less than 41%. Dribble jumpers, 37%. You know, he ranked in the excellent category in synergy and isolation, which we can talk about and dive deeper in. And in the pick and roll, you know, he's not going to be, you know, the number one guard on a team. He certainly can be, but I don't think that's his role and what he's good at. I think he certainly can improve, but he does, you know, he loves to break down defenders in isolation, but he just needs to be a little bit more patient, right? He kind of just settles for tough shots. He kind of just, you know, kind of gets a little, you know, antsy, you know, when the ball's in his hands, but he certainly is capable of doing all those things. But during his hot streak, you know, kind of ended, I believe like February 15th with his last 20-point game. And it kind of just went downhill from there. Especially with his assist percentage, I believe it's around, 7%. So if you're looking at that, we can certainly dive in. You don't really want to see those numbers, from, you know, the type of prospect Ian Jackson is. And I certainly hope those numbers get better. And if you're looking, you know, farther back at OTE, he's definitely, you know, improved in, you know, his turnovers. He only averaged about 1.2 per game, at UNC. And he had a steal rate of 1.3%, turnover rate 13%. So, definitely can improve in those areas, but I want to, give it up to you, Nick, to kind of see what your thoughts are with him.
Yeah. I mean, my biggest thought on him is for better and worse, I don't think there's been a more difficult time to be a combo guard than right now. And some of that is bias of, you know, following the Sacramento Kings team that has 7 combo guards, 5 centers, and nobody else. But, you know, I think just even in general in the NBA, if you're not a big shooting specialist type of guard, you need to be able to create for others as well as yourself to some degree. And you know, we didn't bring up the passing for Magoon-Gwath because it really isn't there, but averaging under an assist per game and having a negative assist to turnover ratio as a big man of his type is, you know, it's a concern, but it's not a huge problem.
Like, right? An alarm. Yeah.
Averaging under an assist per game and having a negative assist to turnover ratio as a 6'4" guard, it's a real concern for me. And that's, I'm curious how much time he gets on the ball as, you know, not just as an ISO guy this year, but as, you know, as someone who can create for others. You dove into some of the synergy numbers. The one that stood out to me the most is last year he ranked in the 18th percentile in pick and roll ball handler frequency and in the 95th percentile in terms of efficiency, right? And if you include passes, he's in that same 95th percentile range, right? A lot of the mistakes that he makes in terms of turnovers are in isolation. And as you mentioned, he's not a high turnover player. He's just also not a high assist rate player. And so it's the kind of thing where if the ball dies in your hands as a 6'4" guard in the modern NBA, you have to be so spectacularly good. And even if you are so spectacularly good, I mean, I have touted many times that I was too low on Cam Thomas, but even with that, you know, sort of mea culpa factored in, right, is like Cam Thomas did not have that heavy free agency interest that you expect to see from a 24-year-old guard who's averaging 20 points a game, right? And Cam Thomas has taken real strides forward as a playmaker, especially like this last season. He really grew as a playmaker, especially in the short role, in a way that is genuinely very encouraging for his long-term NBA future. But even still, it wasn't enough. And he's not the only person who got really squeezed in restricted free agency. But you know, 15 years ago, if there was a 24-year-old guard who was averaging 22 a game, you know, that guy's getting a max deal that the Nets have to match, right?
Yeah.
And that's where my concern about the archetype comes in of like, look, he's exceptionally talented as a scorer. I love his transition stuff. You know, as you mentioned, he is just a blur. And not only does he get out in transition really quickly, but exceptionally willing. He was in the 98th percentile in transition frequency, right? This is someone who not only is good at running in the open floor, but does it all the time. And that's, you know, that's a really encouraging sign for the offense, especially since his numbers at the basket were not quite as good as his jump shooting numbers that you already brought up. But it's just a real concern for me when you're that size of guard and don't have all that much playmaking in your game, because the bar is just so, so high if you're that kind of player in the NBA today, in a way that, you know, again, even 5-10 years ago, the bar was not, and like, you know, Lou Williams and Jamal Crawford were still, you know, winning Sixth Man of the Year awards, right? That's,
yeah,
you know, Cam Thomas had a better scoring season last year than either of those two guys ever did in their entire careers, and the money wasn't there in restricted free agency. And that's really my biggest concerns with Ian Jackson, are just all, can he create enough for others? The defense was inconsistent, but he's got ridiculous athletic tools. I buy into him improving dramatically on that end. The shooting touch clearly showed itself. I'm not worried about that. I, again, you know, part of the reason I think this is such a make or break year for him is I think he'll have the ball in his hands at St. John's a lot more than he did at UNC, you know, mostly because of the Elliott Cadeau of it all. But even like, it's the kind of situation where if we get to the end of the year and he's at 3 assists and 3 turnovers a game, I would be much happier with that outcome than if we see another year where he keeps the turnovers low, but still is under an assist per game. Like, even if, you know, it's 3 assists to 3.5 turnovers and it's a negative assist to turnover ratio, I would much rather have that. And this is, you know, speaking of the previous co-host that I mentioned up top, one of the discussions that Metcalf and I had that year that sticks with me is we had a debate between Alondis Williams and Iverson Molinar, and neither of them have carved out particularly successful NBA careers. I mean, Alondis Williams has gotten a cup of coffee a few places, which is nice to see. But the whole tenor of that argument was, which would you rather have? A guy who is an exceptional game manager, who doesn't make mistakes, but also doesn't make the home run plays. You know, a guy who never turns the ball over, but, you know, only makes the easy pass, which is why he never turns the ball over. Or a guy like Alondis Williams, who, you know, will throw the absolute most ridiculous passes you've ever seen, and he'll have 3.5 turnovers a game, and some of them will end up in the fifth row. But, you know, he also will be pretty close to leading the conference in assists. And every once in a while, he'll hit some cross-court read to a three-point shooter that is like, that was a dead play. And you just made that possession actually mean something with that pass that there aren't that many people that can see. And that's, you know, that's the kind of thing where, again, especially for someone like Ian Jackson, I would much rather see him just try shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, maybe it doesn't work. Oftentimes it won't work, but, you know, especially if you're a guard of your size who has the kind of scoring arsenal that you do, if you can't use that scoring arsenal to make space for anyone other than yourself, it's a real tough road to climb in the NBA.
Yeah, I totally agree, because, you know, when you look at Jackson, it's a lot of, you know, he makes so much effort on the offensive side of the ball for himself. Where's the effort for his teammates? You know, is he going to set his teammates up? Is he going to take the same risk that he does when the ball's in his hands and, you know, in isolation? You know, can I break down this defender to get to the rim? You know, can I, you know, beat this guy in the open court in a foot race? You know, where are those same type of, you know, mindset when it comes to playmaking for others? I certainly hope that gets better, but as you mentioned, it's going to be a tough road if he doesn't get that figured out. And that just, you know, it made me kind of laugh in my head when you said, you know, just try shit. You know, that's a great quote graphic that I might make after this that we can post on social. But no, just try, because it can't get any worse, right? It can only get better, but obviously there's going to be a few mistakes here and there. And then just, you know, tapping on his, you know, defense a little bit. He needs to learn how to navigate screens better, because a lot of the times, you know, he gets caught so badly and then he just gives up. It could be, you know, at the point of attack, or he a lot of times when he's defending, he's racing behind his defenders trying to catch up, which, you know, he's the fastest guy on the court usually. Why is that the case? So I think just bringing that same effort in terms of his playmaking and defense that he already has in an offensive type of mindset is gonna, you know, work wonders for him in his sophomore season at St. John's.
I do want to talk about the defense, but just one sort of last quick note on the offense before we move fully forward into that. Even though, you know, as you mentioned, he's, you know, making all that effort to create plays for himself, he still wasn't making many mistakes. I mean, again, as you mentioned, like, you know, 1.2 turnovers a game in 24 minutes, that's, you know, that's better than most guards of his archetype. But the problem is again, it's like, you know, because you're not the kind of player that dribbles the ball off your foot, even more reason to be like, okay, you know, I'm not turning the ball over all the time in isolation, right? Coach isn't gonna sit me for like doing something really stupid if I'm creating plays for others. Now, given that Rick Pitino's the coach, you know, he might just bench him for, I don't know.
Yeah.
But
you honestly, know, that might help him out, honestly. You know, he didn't start a lot of games at UNC to start the season, right? And then he had those flashes of, you know, that stint of like, you know, late December, January, and then, you know, February kind of tapered off a little bit, but yeah. I think
single digit assists in February and March, just for the record.
Yeah. And I think he had, I'm trying to look, I had it written down. I think he only had 32 total assists last year as, you know, a combo guard, you know, so, hopefully, you know, with Rick Pitino, you know, that type of, you know, grindy mindset that he instills in his players of, you know, defense is, you know, the name of the game here at St. John's. I think that will kind of just, you know, be a, you know, growth arrow for, you know, Jackson in terms of like, hey, like I need to get better at this. I need to get this with my playmaking to just be a better all around prospect. So when we're, you know, picking parts of his games right there, he'll have a little bit of more, you know, checks in the pros column than cons.
It's odd because I couldn't agree more with your point about the screen navigation. And in a weird way, that's almost encouraging. And the reason that I think it's almost encouraging is he would be far from the first top 10 high school recruit to go to college and assume that all the garbage that I did on the defensive end of the floor, because I was just so much more athletic than everybody else and I could get the chase down block. Oh, the gap is smaller. You know, it's like, it's something that I think about a lot with basically everybody in the NBA whose last name is not Thompson. Is not a 100th percentile athlete, right? Like, you know, even the best of the best, right? Like, even like Zach LaVine is a great example, right? Of like, look, if you think that your athleticism is going to cover every single mistake that you make defensively the way it did in high school, that ain't how it works anymore. The flip side of that, of course, is, well, you know, you have the kinds of tools that plenty of players who have been all defense caliber players or close to it would love to have, right? Like they're, you know, I'm just trying to imagine how incredibly gifted Keegan Murray would be as a defender if he was Ian Jackson's feet, right? It's like he makes up for a lot of it with, you know, great positioning. And, you know, to the flip side of that, right? Keegan Murray's first 3 months in the NBA, he was god awful defensively and he figured it out and he realized, okay, you know, I was more athletic than some guys in college. There aren't going to be that many guys who I'm more athletic than in the NBA. You know, I have a lot of things to figure out. And he figured them out pretty quick. And by the time year two came around, he was a real positive defender. And by the time last year came around, he was genuinely elite on that end of the floor. But, you know, again, it's the sort of, it's a corollary of the you can't teach height thing of like, you cannot teach being as fast as Ian Jackson is. Right. You just either you are or you aren't. And so then the question becomes, okay, rather than just sort of leaning on my high school basketball experience of, you know, if I just turn on the jets, it doesn't matter if the guy's 30 feet ahead of me. I'm going to get there. Right. It's like once you have that adjustment period of, oh, it doesn't quite work like that. Right. It's like some guys don't figure it out. And those are the guys who fall off draft radars pretty quickly. And other guys are like, oh, okay, this was different. Speed of the game is a whole lot faster. And, you know, I can't get away with, you know, lazy is unfair, but like, I can't get away with being indifferent defensively the way that I was in previous stops in my basketball career, because there are guys who, you know, maybe aren't quite as fast as me, but are close enough that I can't give them 30 feet of room and just expect to recover every time. So it's like, it's encouraging to me in the sense of, a lot, like basically all the issues were fundamental, right? It's not like, it's not like he has any sort of lack of athleticism. You know, you can quibble with, you know, okay, because he's listed at 6'5", he's 3 inches too short to be a Maxwell guard. But, you know, for basically every other kind of guard, it's like, okay, you know, he's not tiny. He's got the requisite athleticism. And, you know, it's not like he's a lackadaisical player. Just watch him run out and transition, right? He's not someone who is, you know, indifferent in that way. And so there's a lot of room to grow defensively, but there's also a lot of reason to think that he can grow into that room in a way that, you know, going back to the example I gave previously of Iverson Molinar, he didn't make the NBA because he couldn't guard anybody, right? It's like, that was no fault of his own. He had a lot of injuries and he was small and he wasn't that quick. And it didn't work out because of all that. But Ian Jackson has all the athletic tools. It's just a matter of, okay, can you get over the hump of this is a lot harder than it used to be and I need to adjust?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because, I mean, that's kind of where we're at with him, right? You know, he does have a great build that makes up, you know, he's sturdy, he's strong, right? He has that good athletic, you know, sturdy base that you want and kind of your combo guard, right? But with that same, you know, vertical quickness that he has in the open court where he can just like run freely and he knows I'm going to get you, that's not enough, right? Because if you look at the defensive side of the ball, you know, his lateral quickness is not there. So, you know, just incorporating that mindset and like that strength that he knows he has and just, you know, working that into the defensive side of the ball, I think will do him wonders. But that's something that, you know, I think, you know, when you look at these prospects, right, like it's not, you know, they're great at one thing or two things or, you know, whatever the case may be, but that's not enough in this day and age with just how the NBA is evolving, and especially in college ball. Right. You know, you have a lot of these, you know, the transfer portal is insane. You know, you have all these conference realignments. Like it's so ever changing in terms of, you know, basketball and sports, whatever the case may be. And it's like, how are you going to adapt knowing that you're good at, you know, X, Y, and Z and bringing other attributes to your game that, you know, you need to improve on? It's kind of just, you know, that's the state of everything. But I think he'll figure it out, but I'm super excited to watch him at St. John's. I think this definitely is a make or break year for him in terms of his draft stock.
Yeah, I think you hit one of the key points there, which is it's no longer a one trick pony kind of league. I mean, this is an embarrassing discussion that I had with Nathan last year because I have used Troy Daniels as my example forever and ever and ever. And after years of doing that, Nathan pointed out that he was actually two inches shorter than I remember him being, which you know, actually has kind of a significant impact in terms of the evaluation. But, you know, for me, it was one of those things where it's like, he's just a magical shooter. And that's just not enough anymore. I mean, Ryan Anderson went from like near all-star to out of the league almost immediately. And he wasn't even a one-trick pony. He was like one of the league's best offensive rebounders year after year after year. And as it turns out, being, you know, an excellent shooter at 6'10", but being slow-footed in a league that is emphasizing more skill across positions, more speed across positions, and also has been actively de-emphasizing offensive rebounds for at least a decade now. It's like, okay, you know, if you're going to stick around, you need to have multiple reasons why a coach is putting you on the floor. And, you know, that's been, you know, you mentioned the transfer portal. I think part of the other side of the transfer portal is, you know, a lot of the, you know, Drew Timmies and guy you brought up, Tyler Hansbrough's of the world, you know, they're sticking around in college for 5 years and they're getting paid. And, you know, if they end up having a long and successful pro career outside of the NBA, they've already made their millions, right? It's a different landscape in almost entirely positive ways, in my opinion. The downside is because of the chaos of the transfer portal, it's the kind of thing where it's like, you know, I can't remember who it was. I think it was Mikey Williams, where it was like, he's had 7 coaches in 5 years or something like that. And it's like, that is really the only part of the transfer portal that is concerning to me of how is anyone expected to build any sort of consistency with anything. But, you know, the alternative to that is Ian Jackson is not a really successful in college archetype kind of player, right? Where it's like, you know, with Drew Timmy, it was abundantly obvious to everybody that he was going to continue to dominate until he was not allowed to play in the NCAA anymore. And then, you know, he would move on from Gonzaga and maybe he'd get a cup of coffee in the NBA and that'd be it. And that's what his, you know, the first 3 years of his career have proven out so far, right? Ian Jackson is not the kind of player who you can see succeeding against sort of a lower bar of athleticism, lower bar of size in the way that, you know, your Tyler Hansbroughs in the past, your Luka Garzas, your Drew Timmy's, like, the list is very long of very successful college players who, for one reason or another, pretty much everybody was sure we're going to have an uphill climb to be successful in the NBA. That's not Ian Jackson at all. And so a lot of the issues with him are cleaning up around the margins. And if he can clean up around the margins, and I mean, really, he needs to take a big step forward as a playmaker. That's not a margins thing. But especially defensively, you know, if he can just push through screens a little bit harder, if he can just, you know, be, I don't want to see be less confident, because anytime you tell a basketball player to be less confident it's going to screw with their shot for the rest of their lives. But like, you know, just generally speaking of like, hey, if you continue to give guys this much room, they're going to blow by you, right? Your advantage athletically is not as large as it used to be. And that's the kind of thing that, as long as the requisite effort is there, which in other areas of his game, Ian Jackson has absolutely shown that effort, can he clean up enough of the defense to earn himself the room to develop the playmaking slowly over time? And you, as a Phoenix Suns fan, got to see firsthand the development of Devin Booker from, you know, I'm a shooting guard, not a passing guard, to actually he can run the point pretty effectively and, you know, have a couple of 7-assist seasons on just, I was talking the other day with, I forget who it was, but about the season where the Suns went 19-63 and Devin Booker had 27-7, right? It's like, yeah. That's not, you know, just purely the playmaking stuff alone. That's not something you could have reasonably expected from Devin Booker earlier in his career. And you can find examples across the board of that. I mean, Zach LaVine, very similarly, he might not have figured it out defensively, but man, going from the black hole that he was his rookie year to actually, you know, being able to create for others sometimes, it's a pretty big step forward, but it's one that has been made and it's one that Ian Jackson can make. And my biggest questions for him really are, can you clean up the stuff that's easy to clean up quickly enough that you can get the run you need to develop the stuff that's going to take longer? And for me, that's the playmaking over pretty much anything else.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad you brought that up too, because, you know, you were talking about, you know, the Jude Timmies of the world. You know, he, you know, his, one of his teammates is Bryce Hopkins, which, you know, after, you know, he had his knee injury, you know, he was one of the best players in college basketball that he's going to be, you know, alongside with. And that's going to just open up, you know, playmaking for him, to be able to set a guy like him up at the college level. You know, who knows if he'll, you know, get an NBA, you know, contract or, you know, be able to, you know, sneak in there. But he's also going to be paired with Sellers, who was a deadly shooter from USC. So as you have, you know, floor spacing, I think with his, you know, archetype, I think he's going to be more prone to, you know, be able to see these guys on the floor and be able to create for them just because of, you know, the scheme that they're going to be in at St. John's. So, just to end things off, quick, I guess we're just going to say our big boards, but, I had Jackson at 45. So definitely still in that second round to start the season, but I wouldn't be surprised, you know, to start the season if he moves up a little bit, here and there, as the college basketball is almost here. So.
Yeah, I mean, the NBA season is opening as we're recording, which we will talk about in just a minute. I'm trying to quickly pull up my board to find where I had Ian Jackson. I am failing, so let's just move on before this gets even more
awkward. He's probably not even on there.
no comment. All right, so just one more quick break, and then we will get into our last section right after this.
Yo, it's Jey Uso from WWE,
and I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer, SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today, and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win.
Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
All right, quick hits. So we've done something similar to this on Deep Dives before, but now we're going to make it into more of an actual segment. So right at the very end, after the two prospects who we dove deep on, just, you know, sort of run through the main basketball news of the day. And the main basketball news of the day today is pretty obvious. It's opening night. We are recording.
Thank God.
It's been a long offseason, but we are recording towards the end of Rockets Thunder. Houston currently up 7 on OKC. And yeah, so just, you know, for quick hits, opening night, Warriors Lakers has not started yet. Some of us may have forgotten that tonight was opening night because the team that they follow most closely does not play until tomorrow. So, you know, not naming names, but Nick Akers Johnson. But yeah, I mean, it's two marquee matchups to start off the NBA calendar. And yeah, it's a new look Rockets against the sort of old dominant OKC Thunder. I mean, you know, you might be double screening this in a way that I am struggling to because my mind is in 74 different places at once right now, but we're back. You know, NBA basketball is back. It's been a very long off season, but you know, the start of the college season's right around the corner. Paige, I'm curious, what are your sort of big storylines that you're looking at for, let's call it the two opening nights, because, hey, this episode will release on the opening night for every team that isn't Houston, Oklahoma City, Golden State, or Los Angeles Lakers.
Yeah, I think, you know, our opening night is technically tomorrow, right, with the Suns and Kings. But just as being a Suns fan, you know,
the KD most brutal opening night matchup you can imagine.
Yeah. Yeah.
It would be us watching and like four other people.
Yeah. Maybe we'll have to make a playback for that and have like one beer to watch.
Maybe we will have to not make a playback for that.
But just, you know, from a Suns fan's perspective, you know, KD is a Rocket, which, you know, he has always been one of my favorite players to watch. But I forget what interview or who was interviewing him. You know, he said, you know, Houston feels like home. You know, obviously he one of the greatest players ever to go through the University of Texas. So, you know, hearing him say that as a Suns fan kind of, you know, shot me in the heart a little bit, but you know what you can do. I think you mentioned in the earlier in the episode, you know, their starting lineup is 6'7" and above, right? Which is like the tallest or one, if not the tallest in the league. And they have really high expectations this year. Obviously, like, they lost Fred VanVleet, to an injury and he's out for the season, which is going to kind of raise some questions, early on. But I think what I've seen, you know, I don't know if you want to do like our West predictions, but those might be bad in terms of, you know, who our fans for, but
15, a lot of them, Utah Jazz, 14, New Orleans Pelicans, 13, Phoenix Suns, 12, Sacramento Kings. Yeah. We good?
That hits the nail on the head. You took the words out of my mouth. But definitely the Rockets, you know, I think, you know, they're kind of, you know, starting the season as like the fourth best team in the West, which, you know, the West is, it goes up and down every year. Anyone, you know, in that, you know, first seven spot obviously has a chance to make the playoffs, right? But I think this game is, you know, they're playing the defending champs, right? You know, Thunder, shout out to my guy Cone. He's at Ring Night right now. biggest Thunder fan ever, but I think, you know, it's just a great new look. You know, obviously Kevin Durant got paid as well. You know, he's making $50 million a year at, you know, 37 years old, but, you know, he's still KD. So I think just how he can, you know, prove to everyone that he can be on a team for, you know, actually stay there is a big question still too. But, you know, he's, you know, ending, you know, he's getting close to that time where he might hanging up, but you know, he might play until he's 50, you know, he's all about hoops. but I think, I'm super excited for this matchup. Obviously, I'll probably watch it tomorrow since we've been recording. And then obviously Lakers Warriors. And with LeBron being out, I think Luka year two Lakers, this is his team. Obviously, he's in the best shape of his life, which I'm super excited to see, this season, but I want to know your thoughts too of these two games.
Yeah, I brought up the Rockets lineup earlier because it is fascinating to me. And granted, you know, part of this is not by choice, right? You mentioned the VanVleet injury. They would not be running this lineup of everybody 6'7" and above if VanVleet were playing. But even with that, I mean, to me, it's not just everybody is 6'7" and above. It's one guy is 6'7" and everybody else is 6'11" or 7 foot.
Yeah.
Right. And that's, I think, what really stands out to me the most. This is, God, I feel ancient saying this. This is my 10th year covering basketball in some semi-professional or professional capacity. And it just blows my mind to think that anybody would be running out a lineup where they have 4 7-footers out there when, you know, the NBA that I first started covering professionally, it was like, there are maybe 3 7-footers that are worth anything. And then everybody else, it's like, no, we want to have a lineup where everybody is, you know, between 6'5 and 6'9 and they can switch across every possible position. And, you know, I think a lot of, it's funny that you brought up Kevin Durant because I don't think, you know, speaking of Rockets Thunder, I don't think we get Chet Holmgren as Chet Holmgren without Kevin Durant. I don't think we get Chet Holmgren as Chet Holmgren without Kevin Garnett. I think in both of those cases, famously, Kevin Durant and Kevin Garnett both said that they were shorter than they were because if they said they were any taller, they would never have played anything other than center, right? And it's like, you know, Kevin Garnett said, yeah, I'm 6'13". It's like, okay, we all know what that means, right? It's like, but, you know, it used to be like, it was particularly funny that Kevin Durant is starting at shooting guard tonight because that's where he began his career. Like in Seattle, he was the starting shooting guard. Yeah. And, you know, it was revolutionary at the time. And at the time, he was listed at 6'9", right? And it's like, you know, there's one picture that I will never get over, which is Kevin Durant standing next to DeMarcus Cousins. And it's like, okay, so one of you is listed at 6'9", and the other is listed at 6'11". And the guy who's listed at 6'9" is quite obviously taller than the other guy. Yeah. Right. But it's like, you know, DeMarcus Cousins was also 270. He was perfectly fine being center, right? He's like, I don't have to lie about my height to be, you know, put in a position that actually makes sense for me. And, you know, now we see with Chet Holmgren and Victor Wembanyama and, you know, even Anthony Davis to a similar extent of like, we want to have another big man out there with these guys to protect them so that they, you know, something that was both necessary and also bothered me a lot about Keegan Murray last season for the Sacramento Kings is he was basically forced to play power forward. And, you know, he put on a lot of bulk in the offseason that really messed with his shot. Like the first couple months of the season, he was shooting 28%, which is, you know, the number that people think. But, you know, watching his shots, like basically every single shot was long. And, you know, it took about 2 weeks of that for me to realize, oh, of course, every single shot is long. He's, you know, much stronger than he's been at every other point in his NBA career because he was forced to put on weight. You know, the opposite of the discussion we were having earlier of like, you know, Wemby putting on weight slowly is like he was forced to put on that weight because the team had no power forwards. And so like, of course, it's no surprise that he's long on every shot because he's known how much effort he needs to put into the ball every time he shot it his entire life. And now that's a different amount of effort because he's stronger than he used to be. Right. And it's like if Chet Holmgren had come into the NBA at the same time as Kevin Durant, he almost certainly would have been forced to play center the first few years of his career. He probably would have said, no, I'm 6'10", instead of like his entire, you know, AAU, high school, college career. It's like, yeah, I'm 7'1", because that's how tall I am. And I don't have to like, and granted, you can't really hide that anymore with, you know, the measurements that the NBA does in the combine. But even still, it's like, there's been a long tradition of, you know, skinnier ball handling fluid types who tried to pretend that they were shorter than they were because, you know, they weren't going to get to play the way they wanted to once they reached the NBA. I mean, you can go all the way back to Ralph Sampson, who, like, you know, when he was at Houston and he had Akeem Olajuwon alongside him, it's like, okay, this guy can be a 7'4" stretch forward, right? If Ralph Sampson came into the NBA 40 years later, his career looks very different. But, you know, instead, part of it is just the medical care. I mean, once you're that tall, it's pretty much impossible to stay healthy regardless. And it was a whole lot harder 40 years ago than it is now. But even still, there was just this sort of concept of if you're a 7-footer, you're a center. And Kevin Durant, you know, the Kevins, really, it's Kevin Garnett and Kevin Durant did more to erase that than anybody before them. And it's really funny to me that Durant is almost, you know, you mentioned the University of Texas going to Houston thing, right? It's full circle in that regard. It's also full circle in the regard of him starting the year as the starting shooting guard when there's been a whole long evolution from start to finish of that. But back when he first played shooting guard, he had to pretend he was a lot shorter to get listed as shooting guard.
And on the flip side of that, just a quick note, it's so funny that you brought that up of just like the evolution of the game. And like, obviously that's such a, you know, apparent thing with anything, especially, you know, in basketball, but you know, with point guards or, you know, they're trying to be taller, right? If you look at back at, you know, Scoo, 2 years ago, you know, there's tons of question. Is this guy 6'1"? Is he 6'2"? You know, he has huge hands. Like, is it just, you know, in my head, right? So I think, you know, it's so funny when you look back because it's like, he was basically the, you know, the guy that kind of started this revolution of, you know, versatility of, you know, the stretch fours of the world and, you know, the perimeter players if you're, you know, over 6'9 and above, which, you know, obviously Kevin Durant's probably 7 foot, but, and also with just, you know, going back on the Rockets too, you know, he is, you know, the vet on this team, right? Which is kind of the first time in his career where he, you know, he doesn't have, you know, Steph to bail him out or, you know, Devin Booker to look to or, you know, Klay Thompson or, you know, those players of the world, you know, he has Jabari Smith, you know, I'm super excited to how he plays with Sengun. You know, he hasn't really had that, you know, at Phoenix, he didn't really have that playmaking center, to help him out. So I think their dynamic will be super fun to watch.
All right. Anything else before we wrap things up here?
I think we're good.
All right. Well, thank you all so much for joining us on the new version of the Deep Dives podcast. She is Paige Otto. You can find her on social media at @PaigeOtto_. You can find her work on NoCeilingsNBA.com. You can find me on Blue Sky at NBA Johnson. You can find my written work on NoCeilingsNBA.com as well. Again, as we are recording this, NBA opening night is underway. So it's a fun time in the basketball world with the start of the college season right around the corner. And as always, we've got a ton of great content for you over at No Ceilings across all social media, across YouTube, No Ceilings TV, any platform you might want to find draft or NBA related content. We got you in some capacity or another. If you've been enjoying the show, please take the time to leave a rating and or a review in whatever podcast player you might be using, preferably 5 stars. That's always much appreciated on our end. And if you have any feedback regarding the deep dives portion of the show, feel free to reach out to me on Blue Sky as mentioned or email nickaj.nba@gmail.com. And as always, thanks so much for listening.